Okay, Paul's letter to Titus. Today will be part 5 of 132. So, last Sunday we spent our time looking at the first 4 verses, which consists of Paul's greeting to Titus. Today we'll pick things up where we left off. We'll be ready for verse 5, so if you want, you may want to go ahead and turn there at this time, if you would. As stated numerous times here, the key to following Paul's train of thought in this letter is, of course, having a good grasp of the background material, especially the reason the letter was written, the situation at hand, and its key themes. So, again, just to sort of encourage you, if you missed any of that, which we covered the first 3 weeks of this series, you could get actually caught up if you just go to the website and listen to the first half of part 3. That would give you a pretty good summary of the background. I mentioned a while back that we should be able to move through the body of this letter pretty easily, as there aren't too many difficult passages to deal with. We have a few that will require some discussion, but not a lot. However, we do have one of those today. It's not real difficult, but it does need a little explaining. I also mentioned that there will be certain verses that will address a particular subject that I'll want to take some extra time to talk about, and that will be the case for today as well. Here in chapter 1, Paul reminds Titus of his assignment there at Crete. He has been left there to take care of unfinished business, which involves appointing elders in the various churches, verses 5 through 9, and silencing certain false teachers, verses 10 to the end of the chapter. This morning, we're going to start in on that short section that outlines the qualifications of elders. So follow with me as we read through those verses, starting with verse 5. Paul writes, "The reason I left you in Crete was that you might put in order what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. An elder must be blameless, faithful to his wife, a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Since an overseer manages God's household, he must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what is good, who is self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that he can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it." All right, so for this morning, actually, we're just going to cover verse 5 and the first half of verse 6. An accurate translation of verse 5 would read something along the line of that you might straighten out what was left unfinished, which actually some versions of the Bible, that's how they render it. It's kind of a mixed metaphor. Straighten out implies that something needs to be corrected. Unfinished implies something needs to be completed. But in this situation, both, of course, are true. There was some lingering disorganization in these young churches at Crete, all of which could be fixed by doing what had yet not been done, appointing responsible leaders in each of those churches. And some of this disorganization and lack of sound leadership resulted in unruly teachers worming their way in, and they used their influence to actually downplay godliness and to instead push the observance of certain Jewish rituals. You may remember from 2 weeks ago that one of the arguments used to contest Paul's authorship is that this letter reflects a leadership structure that is believed to be too sophisticated for a first century church and better represents what we would expect for something well into the second century. But as I stated then, you know, what we see here in Titus certainly doesn't appear to be very sophisticated. Not at all. In fact, it's very basic, very simple. Paul simply tells Titus to appoint elders, mentions a number of qualifications, and that's basically it. He doesn't address questions like how long do they serve, do the congregations ever get to vote on them, who appoints their replacements, how much authority do they have, what exactly are their responsibilities, what happens if they can't get along with each other, should there be a presiding elder among them, how old do they need to be to serve? What is the process for removing an elder? How old in the faith do they need to be? How often should they meet? And on and on and on. You know, the kinds of stuff that fills the pages of bylaws and church constitutions today. And so again, what we find here in Titus is very basic. Paul doesn't address these other organizational matters. He does, however, want to make sure that those who serve will be godly, responsible, and competent. And perhaps the thinking here is this. If you have such sound, mature men leading the church, all the other concerns about structure and processes will work themselves out okay. The real issue is the character and ability of those who do serve. The word elders is one that Paul often uses in his writings. The early church inherited this word, actually, and the concept mainly from the Jewish synagogue. We typically would think of elders as meaning old men, but technically it refers to leaders. The word is used interchangeably in the New Testament with other words like overseers, shepherds, pastors, and if you're using the King James, you would find the word bishops. All those words seem to refer to different roles of the same office. In verses 6 through 8 then, Paul spells out the qualifications. Let's look at them again. Blameless, husband of one wife, whose children believe and are not wild, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain, must be hospitable, must love what is good, be self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. Verse 9, then, is not so much a qualification as it is a job description, or rather, you know, a charge, what an elder must do. One question that sometimes comes up is this: are these qualifications situation-specific or intended to be universal? In other words, are they meant for just the churches at Crete because of the situation there, or for all churches at all places at all times? Well, the fact that this list is virtually the same as the one that Paul lays out in his first letter to Timothy for the church there at Ephesus would, of course, strongly indicate that these qualifications are indeed universal. Plus, when you look at each one, none of them have a sense of being situation-specific. They're the kinds of virtues we would expect of any church leader. In fact, from other New Testament passages, we see that these virtues are expected of all believers. They all reflect a lifestyle that resembles, you know, that key word here in Titus, godliness. Evidence that such a person has been truly converted and has made a clean break, has made a definite break from the values and lifestyle of the fallen culture that he lives in. And so for those on this island, their culture was especially depraved, and all the more reason that break from the Cretan way of living had to be genuine and had to be noticeable. The first thing Paul says here is that an elder must be blameless, or in some translations, they'll render it above reproach, means the same thing. The fact that this word is first in the list and then repeated again later in verse 7 suggests that being blameless is the primary qualification of which all the others kind of just help to define. And so instead of blameless with a comma after it, it might be better to think of it as blameless with a colon after it. And this certainly does seem to be, a plausible way to look at it. But regardless of how it is to be understood, the end result is, of course, the same. The qualifications are all essentially non-negotiable. Anyone who serves as an elder must be measured by them. My plan is to work us through each of these on this list. We've covered these in the past, and so this will be somewhat of a review. Everything here is pretty straightforward. I think we all know what it means to not be quick-tempered or overbearing or given to drunkenness. But there are a couple here that have prompted some discussion, even debate. It's not entirely clear what Paul meant, and so we'll want to spend some time on those. And they are found actually right here at the beginning, there in verse 6. The first one deals with an elder being the husband of one wife, and the second one addresses his children, that they must be believers and well-behaved. And as you can see, both of those deal with the quality of one's home life. We'll tackle the first one this morning, and then the other one in 2 weeks, the Sunday when we come back from the picnic. The statement there in verse 6 has basically been translated in three different ways. The husband of one wife, or faithful to his wife, or married only once. How many have Bibles that say the husband of one wife? Get kind of a snapshot here. How many have Bibles that say faithful to his wife? Okay, a few. Anyone have a Bible that says married only once? Okay, it's actually in the New Revised Standard Version, if you use that. So, which is it? I mean, there's certainly differences here. Well, the statement comes from three words in the Greek, and it's the same three words that are used in the list in 1 Timothy as well. A word-for-word rendering of those words would provide us with four different possibilities. One wife man, one wife husband, one woman man, one woman husband. All right? Hopefully I have those Greek words copied correctly. Denny will be all over me because he just taught us Greek in his little E4 class. And don't tell on me. All right, so what do these three words mean here? Well, throughout the centuries, various interpretations have been proposed. One is that the elder must be married. Secondly, another one, that an elder can only have one wife his entire life. Another one is that he be monogamous. He only have one wife at a time. Those three, as you see, all deal with one's marital status. And then the fourth interpretation is that he be faithful to his wife, be wholly devoted to her. So let's look at each one. The first position is actually a very wooden interpretation, that a pastor or a married, or that a pastor or elder must be married is actually kind of difficult to defend. It would mean, for instance, that a widower would be unqualified. It seems unlikely that Paul would have a restriction like that in mind. Like the day his wife died would be the day he would have to resign as a pastor or elder of a church. Seems unlikely. It would also mean that Jesus would not have been qualified. Sorry, Jesus, we can't let you serve as a pastor here until you wear a wedding ring. And this position is very difficult to reconcile with what Paul himself says in 1 Corinthians 7 about the advantages of remaining single so as to serve the Lord without distractions. And using the same reasoning to say that an elder has to be married, we would have to say that he also has to have children. For the next verse mentions the children of a man being considered. And this would mean that a couple who are unable to have children, who had children but then perhaps died unexpectedly, such a husband would be unqualified. The more reasonable approach here is to see that in this list, here in Titus, Paul was simply presenting a typical situation, a married man with a family, very typical in that day. And if he were married, then in that marriage, he must be such and such. And along that line, if he has children, then those children must be such and such. A second interpretation proposes that the man have only one wife his entire life. He could not, for instance, be divorced and then remarried. And this is actually a very common interpretation that many evangelical churches hold to. However, it too is difficult to defend. Could a man who had a failed marriage before he became a believer never, never be able to serve as a pastor or church leader after conversion? Now, some churches realize the problem with that hard line, and so they will make an exception for situations like that. But if one's interpretation is married only once, then where in the text can you find that exception, or any exception? Or what if the one being considered for eldership were the innocent party in a divorce that takes place even after conversion to Christ? The wife, for instance, has an affair, leaves him to marry her lover. You know, this kind of thing actually does happen. Does this in itself make him unsuitable to lead a church? If he can only be married once his entire life, then this would also rule out a widower who remarries. So again, the question is this really what Paul was intending? Well, these are just a few examples of how this second interpretation, has all sorts of problems unless you start cramming exceptions into it. A third interpretation, also very common, and is perhaps the easiest and least controversial to go with, is that an elder be monogamous. He just has one wife at a time. And this certainly fits well into that word-for-word rendering of those three Greek words, as you see. And as attractive as that is, it is, however, very unlikely that this is what Paul meant. Polygamy was actually illegal in the Roman Empire and never practiced in the Greco-Roman society. And we have no indication that Christians ever practiced polygamy. And so to make monogamy a qualification for a church elder seems rather strange. There are problems with all three of these interpretations. Furthermore, they all deal, again, with one's actual marital status, which that itself seems to be out of place. The list of qualifications Paul gives here are virtues that deal with one's character, that in one way or another comments on his blamelessness. Blamelessness. All right. And so this leads us to the fourth interpretation, which I find to be quite compelling and is reflected by those translations that render the words faithful to his wife. Essentially, an elder must be a one-woman man, a one-woman husband. That is, if he is married, he is to be faithful to his wife, both emotionally and sexually. He isn't flirting with other women. He isn't fantasizing about other women. He isn't letting his eyes roam where they shouldn't be roaming. He is single-minded, single-hearted, wholly devoted to her, and only her. And this interpretation, as you can see, actually fits that word-for-word rendering of the Greek very, very well. A popular New Testament scholar, Howard Marshall, has noted that the text itself emphasizes the positive, that is, the faithfulness in marriage, rather than prohibiting some specific unsanctioned form of marriage. And so what we would have here would be a church leaders who are setting an example of being faithful husbands, loving their wives as Christ loved the church. And so again, the issue here isn't the marital status, but is moral sexual behavior. After all, one's marital status is not what makes a man morally pure or blameless. I mean, as you know, there are zillions of guys who are married to one wife and married only once, but they are not one woman men, right? We all know this. And even among Christians. And case in point, the rampant use of pornography. It was not an issue back then, but certainly is today. And we must appreciate the fact that this, too, really is a form of fornication and adultery. Any man who's caught up in that stuff, you know, cannot, must not serve as a church leader, period, because he would not be a one-woman man. So again, the case for this fourth interpretation makes really the most sense. It fits the idea behind those three Greek words very well. It can be consistently applied. There's no holes or exceptions you have to try to squeeze in. And also, this, you know, being above reproach in matters of marital fidelity is a natural place to start with such a list of qualifications, because it really does help to define what it means to be blameless. All right, that said, let me stop there and take the rest of my time this morning to address some areas of application. You could refer to this as part two of today's sermon. And I have three applications to get into. One is taken directly from this passage. I want to spend a little time addressing how our own church applies this one-woman-man qualification concerning elders here. The second application, in that I'll go outside the passage a little bit, for here I plan to expand the charge to all married men, not just elders. Marital fidelity, sexual purity is certainly something God feels very strongly about. And in the third application, I'll drift away from the text even more. Here I'll address women. And yet, what I plan to say will certainly fit within the sphere of the subject at hand. So essentially, I have something for everyone, something to make everyone feel a little bit uncomfortable at some point. Elders, potential elders, married men, unmarried men, married women, unmarried women. All right, I have a lot to cover, so let's dive into it. There's no sermon next week, so I'll try to cram two sermons in today so that you make sure you get your money's worth. You like that? All the time we hear of pastors or some church leader who has failed morally and things at the church are a complete mess. There's some affair or sexual sin, something along that line. A third of the members want them fired and booted out. A third of the members want him to stay and continue his ministry. And the other third just don't know what to think. Well, this is an extremely volatile area, not only in the church, but also among its leaders. No pastor or elder is exempt or beyond falling. Extra effort must be taken to put safeguards in place. And while nothing is 100% foolproof, some things can actually prove to be very, very helpful. And one would be, of course, is to have in place an effective deterrent. And in our membership handbook, I think, have one. We spell out quite clearly what the process would be if a pastor or elder were to fall in this particular area. I won't read the whole thing. Originally, I was going to, but the first sentence is really worth noting. We write, "Any pastor or elder who yields to sexual sin shall be terminated immediately, even if he is remorseful. Furthermore, the congregation will be informed about the matter." And we make it, you know, pretty clear, no scrambling around trying to figure out what to do if it were to happen. It's something everyone agrees to coming into this. We also spell out a pretty comprehensive list of examples. We don't want any disputes on what isn't and what is and what isn't a sexual sin. And on that list is viewing pornography. And hopefully this will help a man think twice. Sexual sin among church leaders is a big problem, and this is why our policies here are pretty tough. So a couple questions here come to mind. First, how would you know if a church leader is involved in some sort of affair or sexual sin or pornography? Well, we may not know. One thing we do here to kind of help with that is that each of the elders make a threefold promise to each other. And we kind of revisit this from time to time and restate that promise. And the promise looks along this line. We all promise to stay clean in this whole area. We also promise to confess it and to accept the consequences if there's a failure. And all promise to give permission to ask anytime and the computers, you can look through the files and anything else you need to do. And that's been the practice here for all elders, pastors, and youth ministers for the past 14 years. And this level of transparency is a good policy. And knowing that you're about to sin is certainly a deterrent. You know, you should stop and think about that. But knowing that you will then have to confess that and then it will be made known to everybody is certainly a deterrent, if not more so. And if he were to lie about it, well, these sorts of things have a way of surfacing. Pornography, for instance, is very addicting, and one can become a bit sloppy in feeding that addiction. Two separate times over the years, I have gone into one of the bookstores at Glenbrook and saw an area pastor I knew in the bookstore, went over to say hi, only to find him looking at a dirty magazine. Very awkward situation. It's happened twice, happened with two different pastors. Each one sheepishly told me the same thing. I knew if I picked this up, someone would catch me. And so again, you know, a lot could be said about that, but these sorts of sins have a way of surfacing eventually. And when they do, it means that, at least in this church, the person's leadership ends, period. And I hope that the generations that will follow us here, that this policy will be kept in place and not changed. An elder or pastor's ability to lead a church is only as good as the trust and confidence that the congregation puts in him. They may like him, they may want him to serve, but if he has failed sexually, they will not, deep down, trust him and will always wonder if he will yield to that sin again. A second question related would be this. Could such a man ever serve in church leadership again as a pastor or elder? Let's say that he is truly remorseful, repents, and is eager to return to ministry. Could he? Well, the scriptures don't provide any direct answer to this, but I would not be one that would be quick to say, no, never. But I would say it would take some time. It would definitely take some time. Again, I see the issue here of gaining the trust of others by proving over an extended period of time that this is an area he has control over. And I would think that this would probably take several years. It would probably also depend upon the nature of the sin. If actual adultery were involved, I would think it'd be 10 years anyway, not 6 to 9 months, as we often see to be the case. But this would be my thinking on the matter. Finally on this, it doesn't appear that church leaders are expected to have a higher standard than all other believers when it comes to sexual purity. The standard itself is pretty straightforward and applies to everyone. Celibacy and singleness or fidelity in marriage. And so, for instance, Roman Catholics who forbid marriage for their clergy is just obviously not justified biblically and brings about all sorts of problems. Everybody is held to the same standard, celibacy in singleness or fidelity in marriage. All right, this then leads me to part two under this heading of the application. I want to take a couple minutes to challenge all of our men in the church, regardless of any formal position they may or may not hold here. The scriptures in both the Old and New Testaments are quite clear in addressing matters of sexual purity. Husbands are called to be faithful to their wives, wholly devoted to them. All who are married are to be a one-woman man. Likewise, single men are expected to flee youthful lusts, abstain from sexual relations, and exercise self-control. And if their passions are too great, the temptation too much, then according to 1 Corinthians 7, they should seek marriage. Now, sexual purity is a big subject, and we could spend weeks on it. For today, just to help move things along, I'm going to just stick to the problem of pornography, and I'm not going to treat it exhaustively. Most Christian men don't have affairs or go to strip clubs or hire prostitutes. But many, unfortunately, do mess around with pornography. And I'm not going to take time this morning to explain what needs to be condemned. Surely there is no one here among us who believes that this sort of thing is acceptable. Whether it's a Playboy magazine or going online to a sex website or watching an adult video, we all agree, do we not, that this is something the Lord would not be pleased with, correct? We all have that, okay? It really does amount to a form of fornication and adultery. The purpose of porn is to produce lust, and lust, according to Jesus, is adultery of the heart. So it's very clear. And if you are involved in this, and you need some good, solid advice, counsel from the Scriptures on what to do, well, listen up, I have it for you. Stop it. Stop it. Cowboy up and take control. Exercise some manliness here. Beat that thing into submission. Quit being such a wuss. How can you let a thing like that master you? After you leave here today, you need to take those magazines and videos and anything else you might have and burn them. Pile it all up, throw a bunch of gas on it, light the match and burn it. If you're watching it on the internet, then install a program, something like Covenant Eyes, for instance, or something similar. Covenant Eyes will send a report to two accountability partners with a list of every website you visited that month. It works. It works well. It's worth the nominal monthly fee. Agree that you'll never use the computer without your wife in the room, or your mom if you're unmarried, or your sister, or both. That'd be a deterrent, wouldn't it? There are measures you can take. You know, it may be inconvenient, it may cost money, but in the bigger picture, it is a small price to pay. If you are married, whenever you view pornography, you are sinning against not only God, but also against your wife. And if you are not married, you are sinning against your future wife. There is no way, no way, your wife or your future wife could ever, ever, ever fulfill these unrealistic fantasies that are promoted in pornography. And therefore, you are setting yourself up for all sorts of sexual dysfunctions. You really are. And emotional ones. One's sex life is very fragile. It must be handled with great care. And porn will mess it up. It will break it, just like a shattered mirror. In Proverbs 7, the writer speaks of the young man who is seduced by the adulterous woman. It begins by him walking toward the street corner. He then turns that corner and walks toward her house. It is not that he's intending to go into her home. He just wants to look at it. He just wants to walk by it. Just to kind of fantasize a little bit. Tease himself. You know, can you appreciate the picture here? Again, her house is not in sight. He has to walk to the corner, turn the corner, and then walk to her house. It's all very descriptive of the process, isn't it? Pornography is widely available today, no doubt about it, but there is still effort involved in getting it. And so again, he walks down to her street, not intending anything other than a quick look at where she lives, to sort of tease himself a little bit. But that's not what happens when you read the chapter. It's not what happens at all. We are told that she sees him. She comes out of her house. She meets him in the street. She takes hold of his hand, we are told. Assures him that no one will know, and with persuasive words, takes him into her bedroom. The writer observes, quote, she seduces him with her smooth talk, and all at once he decides to follow her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose. Again, let me draw attention to the words. All at once he decides to follow her. He allows himself to be tempted, he puts himself in a place to be tempted, is tempted, and then lets go and yields to that temptation. And then, in the verses that follow, there is the deep regret. Whether it is yielding to actual physical adultery or to the seduction of pornography, the process of the temptation is the same, vividly described in Proverbs 7. Now, on a personal note, I might add this. I kind of hesitate to do so, but perhaps it might be helpful to some or might help to help highlight the point here. When I was in my young 20s, I found this passage in Proverbs 7 extremely helpful, and it has served me quite well ever since. Since my conversion in 1976, I have never yielded to pornography, not once. Not because I have great willpower, because I don't, but largely because of this passage in Proverbs 7. I read it, I reread it, I studied it, I read it over and over. You know, I wrote it on the tablet of my heart, you might say. Simply put, this passage and others in the Bible helped me to understand the nature of sexual temptation. That the battle isn't fought when the woman comes out to meet you on the street. That's not where the battle takes place, so to speak. But when you look at the street corner and decide to walk down that street, the battle is won or lost at those very earliest of moments. This passage also, quite frankly, scared the I'll just say heebie-jeebies out of me. Still going to hold the PG-13 rating here. The verses conclude with the great loss, a great loss that the young man experienced because of his one foolish act. And so one exercise I assign those who struggle with porn is this. You know, make a list of everything you stand to lose if you continue in this sin. What will cost you? Make a list. It'll cost you your marriage, the respect of your children, the respect of your fellow church members, the respect of your family. It'll affect your own walk with Christ. Could cost you that eventually. Take a couple weeks and write down everything that comes to mind, everything you stand to lose. And reviewing such a list can be quite sobering. Such a list clearly shows that sin will cost you more than what you are willing to pay. And so again, no action is too drastic in this area. If it means never going into a bookstore where those magazines are sold, then that is what you do. If it means throwing the computer away or canceling your internet service, that is what you do. If your right eye causes you to sin, what do? You pluck it out. Now, so much more could be said about this, and you know, I'm sure I will someday, but I need to move on and address our ladies. So part three under the heading of application. And it is here, no doubt, where I'm bound to find myself in some hot water before the morning is over. But I've been in hot water with the ladies of the church before. Two things I want to use this opportunity to address. First, if you are married, you really don't have the option of withholding yourself from your husband. And this, of course, is equally true of men denying their wives as well. But for now, you know, I'm addressing the ladies. I've talked about this in the past. I don't need to elaborate on it too much. In fact, what needs to be said has been said quite well by Paul himself. So I'll read the passage. Because sexual immorality is so common, each man should have his own wife and each woman should have her own husband. A husband should fulfill his marital responsibility to his wife and likewise a wife to her husband. A wife does not have the right over her own body, but her husband does. In the same way, a husband does not have the right over his own body, but his wife does. Do not deprive one another sexually, except when you agree for a time to devote yourself in prayer. Then come together again. Otherwise, Satan may tempt you because of your lack of self-control. If you want your husband to be a one-woman man, then, well, the burden doesn't fall 100% on him. You have a role in that as well. Don't be selfish. When you are exposing your husband unnecessarily to what Paul calls Satan's temptations. The second subject I want to speak to our ladies about has to do with something just as uncomfortable, and this isn't really related to what takes place at home, but what takes place out in the public. And though it can apply to married women, it seems to be more of an issue with those who are unmarried. If I may be so bold, can I be bold? Carrie, can I be bold? All right, thanks. All right, if I may be so bold, you are not helping things when you fail to exercise good judgment when it comes to matters of apparel. There is a reason the New Testament exhorts women to be modest in the way they dress. Now, I understand that this is an area that rests upon subjective judgments. What is modest in the Amish community is going to be a whole lot different than what is modest in a city like San Francisco or Miami. And I'm certainly not interested in setting forth any dress codes. But some common sense, we all would agree that some common sense would be in order. The more skin you show, the greater the distraction, the greater the possibility for your brothers in Christ to be tempted. Now, we don't have a big problem here with this, just occasionally, but it is something that women need to at least be conscious of and conscious of all the time. Everywhere guys go, work, school, restaurants, parks, stadiums, any public event, when you drag them to the mall, you know, every TV show, every movie, whatever it might be, they are faced with distractions all the time from worldly women, non-Christians, who want, by the way they dress, men to lust after them. The church should be the one place where they can go where they don't have to fight this. This should be a safe place for them. And I'm sure that the motive here isn't to trigger anything in guys. It's simply about looking fashionable. But even so, please use some common sense. 1 Timothy 2:9 is still the word of God. It hasn't been ruled obsolete or void yet. Paul says women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control. Or in the NIV, I call upon women to dress modestly with decency and propriety. Propriety, of course, meaning what is appropriate. So enough said, at least for now. Sexual purity is a big subject, and we'll, of course, be visiting it again from time to time in the years to come. We will resume our series on Titus in 2 weeks. So we'll pick things up with the second part of verse 6. We'll tackle the debate on what it means that children of an elder must believe. Different schools have thought about that, so we'll take some time to look into it. At this time, if the musicians could come forward, we'll bring the children in. Forgot to ring the Sunday school bell. And let's stand.